Hi, I'm NG Jones and you're listening to the podcast Sounds About Right, audiobooks to help us understand the world, the book club that's all about learning new things and challenging our perspectives. Hi guys, and welcome to the fifth episode of the podcast. Now, the fifth book I'll be looking into this week is called Moneyland, Why Crooks Now Rule the World and How to Take It Back. And it's written by Oliver Bulow, who is a British journalist. And the book essentially takes us into a journey of Moneyland, which to my understanding is about the lawless, stateless, super rich and the culture of money laundering and tax evasion. The writing is very creative and the metaphors he uses, well, to me, maybe not so much you if you've already listened or read it. And I liked in the first chapter, he mentions Aladdin's cave. So sorry for any Disney fanatics who expect it to be a deep dive into Disney films, but he sets the scene in this book by mentioning Ukraine and its corruption as it brings about the question, what went wrong and why does a place like Moneyland exist? But it's just the vast sums of money which is quoted in the book as being stolen or put into shell or offshore companies. And that's what's so hard to come to terms with. I think in the first chapter, he mentions how officials in Nigeria, Russia, Malaysia and Kenya have hidden their wealth well beyond the reach and oversight of their citizens, with the estimates from World Bank's figures suggesting each year the wealthiest countries returned only about $423.5 million in the 6 years to 2012 of money stolen from developing nations, which represents less than 1 cent of every dollar stolen, which is incredible. And with the way the financial system is set up, the case now is essentially that there is no limit on how much a corrupt official can steal and therefore no limit on how much they can spend. And the money stolen ranges from between $20 billion to an unimaginable $1 trillion, and they end up in Western cities such as Miami, New York, London, Geneva. And to me, it looks like the rich are able to have advantages such as offshore accounts and avoiding taxes, which aren't available to others. And it's also another reason why societies have become less equal but gains little attention. Western governments have struggled to keep ahead of these legal gains but have institutions that keep them broadly honest, whereas in newer and poorer countries, these institutions and traditions don't exist, and officials and politicians have been stealing money. The rich aren't able to be taxed, therefore those least able to have to pay for it. To be honest, to me, I feel as though this does happen everywhere. In some countries, more to a degree than others, but I digress. And in this book, it mentions that, you know, there is a lot of information, to be honest, regarding statistics and findings from NGO organizations and conversations with prominent people within this topic that the author, Oliver Bulow, has spoken to himself, which I think is, while writing the book or maybe while he was researching, one that struck out to me was that in 10 years after 2000, the richest 1% of the world's population have increased their wealth from a third of everything to half. And in Russia, which, if you remember, was a communist country only around 3 decades ago, 5 years since Putin took over, the 4% of Russians Credit Suisse considered to be middle class were worth between 18,000 and 180,000 saw their collective wealth increase to $137 billion, whereas the upper class, which is about 0.5% of the nation that have more than 180,000, saw their wealth increase by $687 billion. The top 10% of Russians own 87% of everything in the country, a higher proportion than any other country in the world, but this has been made possible by Western enablers, such as lawyers and accountants who are able to move money and hide it. And to be honest, what that says to me is that those figures is what we know about, and how much they really have could be something we could never really be 100% sure of, which is very scary. And for those who aren't well-versed into finance, I also liked how the second chapter does go into how even the concept of Moneyland was created. And it goes back to mention how things were just after the Second World War. And I have to admit, the more I have read or listened into, you know, books about social sciences or about the world's history, the more I really am getting to notice just how much things are in place to this day are as a result of things not long after the World War. Like, for instance, the EU, decolonization, the financial systems, and to a certain degree, as the book mentions, how it was agreed that the dollar will be the world currency, which led to the creation of the International Monetary Fund in 1944, so that money was only allowed to move overseas to speculate long-term investments, not short-term currencies or bonds, and essentially to stop dictators from manipulating currencies. However, the banks in London realised if you use dollars outside the US, the US officials can't touch them, so stateless dollars can flow between countries calmly and it couldn't be stopped, and therefore bankers issued bonds, which was known as euro bonds, where, okay, without making it sound complicated, the bond was issued in one country, have the interest paid in another to avoid tax, and to have the bonds listed in Britain despite it not being issued in Britain. Also, they pretended that the bonds were one company, but really it was another, like a company within a company. This was essentially playing countries' jurisdictions off each other, but it created a bond which no one had to pay tax on its interest and can be turned back into cash anywhere. The secret is that the bonds must be anonymous, and whoever possessed it owned it. Before Eurobonds, hidden money couldn't do much, whereas now it can earn interest without having to pay tax, and it also can be carried and redeemed anywhere. And this more or less created what is the theme of this book. And it's also quoted in many chapters, and it's steal, hide, spend. So yeah, I liked how the book more or less explained how from the first idea of an offshore account was created, and as my background wasn't in finance at all, but I have always been curious to know, and essentially it looks like smart bankers were basically playing a pick and mix game. But what brought this even further is the actual nations being set up as tax havens. For instance, the book mentions the island of Nevis and goes into details of how after they had their independence from the British, the tiny island needed to think of ways to have income, and now the industry brings in 5 million in fees for the government. For an island with a population of a small town, it helps the country provide the resources for its people to prosper, and therefore it lends its jurisdiction to the rich who, for whatever reason, thought their country was too overbearing, whether it be women getting too much in divorces or how high the taxes were. And we all know how effective rich lobbyists are more than the genuine will of the people, as I mentioned in the third podcast, which I talked about the book The People Versus Democracy, which I do recommend you give a listen. But for many of the super rich, the process of trying to get these laws to change has been replaced by the idea of just asset protection. So instead of campaigning for to change these laws, they've more or less opted out of them. And there are some countries which the book does mention throughout, almost like it's, I don't know, repeat offenders. But the book mentions Equatorial Guinea and Nigeria throughout the chapter Nasty as a Rattlesnake, and I interpreted it was like a commentary on just why so many ex-colonies were the way they are. For instance, I thought that it stating that colonies were created and run to enrich the colonial powers was a bold statement. But when you look at the fact that the minister's jobs were to extract value from the economy and send it home, so that basically state export agencies set prices for products all across Africa, and was said to have been created to help farmers, but agencies would underpay for goods and resources produced by peasants and its people, send it abroad and sell for much more. After the World War, countries gained their independence. Some changed their names, some changed their flags, but the decisions taken by those in government more or less remain the same. And the book doesn't shy away from bringing in the quote from other books, which I do like. And so essentially, I'm going to be saying a quote within a quote, because it's in the book, but from another book. And he mentioned Robert Bates' 1989 book called Markets and States in the New Tropic of Africa. And the quote is that after independence, the new governments have maintained the export agencies, but have just continued the scams and given the money to cronies instead of old Western masters. And it's clear that all across the world, countries born in a glory storm of nations, which was a post-Second World War period, had gone wrong, with the rulers of the newly independent nations looting their people, showing that although heavily reported as one, this wasn't just an African problem. And S. Rajaratnam, the former deputy minister prime minister rather of Singapore was a part of a government that, although authoritarian and impatient with democracy, insisted on honesty from its civil servants and ministers, which oversaw a remarkable economic success. And I can't talk about this book without mentioning the other quote that's mentioned. And it's put as part of a book quoting from Rajaratnam that he wrote in November 1968, and it was about 3 years into his 25-year stint as Singapore's prime minister, which was made out as a concern to some of the ex-colonies being looted, which he described as a gradual degradation in morals in which the idealism of the first post-independence years had fallen away, and which ministers and officials have lost the pride they had taken in almost puritanical lifestyle now. Politicians are living in a degree of luxury that simply cannot be squared with their official salaries, while their wives attended official functions in gowns and jewels they should not have been able to afford. Mathematics dictate that if a crooked politician was to keep getting richer, he must steal even more, which will anger his subjects. That means he must buy the support of more and more officials, which will require more money, which will contribute to more theft and will bring more public anger. He must win all instruments of the state power, the army, the police, the entrepreneurs, the bureaucracy. If he must loot, he must allow all his subordinates from the secretary to the office to join in on the game. In most developing countries, a few years of this kind of freebooting affluence led to an economic anarchy, political instability, and the eventual replacement of democracy by civilian or military aristocracy. That seems like a lot to unpack, that statement there, but the book also just mentions how Rajaratnam then rejected economic theories that corruption can aid economic development by oiling the wheels of commerce and ensuring businesses were able to operate with minimal interference. He said that, on the contrary, that there is nothing beneficial in that corruption at all. And a society that is indulgent on corruption is not a liberal, sophisticated society inspired with a shrewd understanding of human nature. He referenced the socialist Stanislav Adretsky, who referred to these nations as being a kleptocracy, a society of the corrupt, for the corrupt, by the corrupt. And I think I will be doing a lot more reading into Stanislav Adretsky's work, because the quote in this book from him is nothing short of spot on. And he said that the problem is not just the extraction nature of the government of colonies, but that their very structure of the countries too. Since so many of these new states have been created by European powers with no concern of local and political realities and no knowledge of their history and no curiosity of whether the inhabitants had a sense of belonging to a shared entity, it's hardly surprising that many officials lack the patriotism necessary to refrain from corruption. So these officials feel ties not to these countries, or their countries rather, but to their families and ethnic kin, and acted accordingly. What is regarded as dishonesty in countries with well-indoctrinated political ideas may appear as morally in order to societies where the bonds of kinship are strong and the concept of a nation is something very recent and artificial. He was therefore one of the first thinkers to recognize that corruption is like a pyramid where the rulers are extracting large sums from the top while the state employees have to take bribes to feed themselves as at the bottom, and the bribes collected from citizens replace the money the ruler stole, meaning the government would outsource the collection of its illicit wealth to everyone employed by the government. And Adretsky didn't condemn the low-level officials who took part in the pyramids, recognizing they had no choice on how to operate in a system that was designed to have them behave corruptly. But he was clear that corruption is disastrous when it affected the whole country and does nothing to contribute to any healthy development, but it distorts the whole economy. And important decisions are determined by ulterior motives, regardless of what effect it has on the community. He said that the most accurate reflection of African political reality were often found in novels rather than textbook, partly because it was unfashionable to doubt the honesty of newly appointed governments, but mainly it was hard to write something negative about a kleptocratic government without being expelled. And he mentioned Chinua Achebe and the author of Things Fall Apart, but he also mentioned his book No Longer at Ease, which essentially is a story about a man from the tribe of Igbo who leaves his village for an education in Britain and then a job in the Nigerian colonial civil service, but is conflicted between his African culture and Western lifestyle. A very, very good read. And I am not just saying that, honestly. It's just very interesting how sometimes literature can explain a real life situation a lot more better than anything else. And that book literally done that for me whilst I read it. So yeah, I definitely recommend it to anyone that want to read it. But in terms of Moneyland, I just found so interesting that how the book really breaks down why corruption in Africa had come about in the 21st century. And throughout the book, there is mention of Mr. Abacha, who had $600 million found in his account, and his son had $137 million found. I just can't begin to imagine how far 600 million can go in healthcare, infrastructure, education, but instead it's hidden in an account offshore. How much money does one person need? And what I just liked about the book is also that the author probably knows so many different stories which can help highlight Moneyland and how the rich behave to hide their wealth. However, he'll dedicate a whole chapter with the aim of highlighting a specific part of how Moneyland operates. For instance, the chapter which goes into detail on how all these affects the property industry, or the chapter which mentions the death of Alexander Litvinenko, or the chapter on the UK's tough libel laws, which makes it very difficult to write about the assets or dealings of an insanely wealthy person, because if their lawyers come to file a libel lawsuit, the reporting companies may believe in whatever article they're talking about, but to publish information could be all but true, but they cannot afford the legal fees it will cost, so they just end up abandoning it anyway, and whoever the person is in question gets to maintain their level of secrecy, and this essentially works in favour of Moneyland. What I also found interesting is just how the book does mention the hypocrisy of the US and how they have states such as Nevada that have some interesting trust laws, which essentially allows asset protection. And it means that provided 2 years has passed since the property had been put in a trust, creditors don't have a way of getting a hold of it, similar to how things are in Nevis. So if a man owns a company and puts it in a trust and divorces, even his wife or kids won't be able to have access to it. Also in Nevada, you can be a beneficiary of your own trust, which is madness. These are potentially attractive prospects, but didn't convince those wealthy enough to put their money there instead of Switzerland, as the US had protective law enforcement. So the concept of Moneyland in America is only okay with Americans and foreign wealthy people who much prefer to keep it out of the reach of their hands of their own government. But this has changed since America cracked down and basically knocked Switzerland out of the secrecy game and had a state on its own country essentially offering to do just the same thing. And it just brings a question, how are they able to get away with doing something like that? Well, it's America. So yeah, you can tell the book does go into great detail discussing Moneyland and just how the rich are able to hide their money. I read some of the reviews after reading the book and the general feel has been mostly anger. Like if you're a citizen in any major cities of a world where property prices far outstrip the average salary and you're working an honest job, trying to make it in the world, but you know that the knock-on effect of you not being able to buy a home in the area you've grown up in is because of lax laws around people being able to hide their money into properties within wherever you live. And it's hard not to feel slightly irritated about it, or when you hear about how some rich officials in certain countries live in luxury whilst the people in their country are suffering with higher illiteracy rates and low life expectancies, poor healthcare. Once again, it just brings a question, how much money does one person need? Okay, guys, that was Moneyland by Oliver Burlow. And that was the things about the book that sounded about right to me. And that is all I have for you today, guys. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast. Please do get in touch with me about your book recommendations, or tell me what part of this book you found interesting, if you'd already given it a read or listen, or whether this podcast has encouraged you to give it a read or listen. Please do let me know what your thoughts were about it. I feel as though us sharing and speaking about it helps the information circulate and stay with us for a lot longer and creates even more personal relationships between ourselves and the books. So we'll be able to remember the valuable and incredible information, which sounds about right. I have been your host, NG Jones, and I'll catch you on the next episode.